Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book business. I'm David Willick, your host. Today I'm talking to Charles Alexander. He's the founder and operator of Chax Press, C-H-A-X, which is located in sunny, warm Tucson, Arizona. Hi, Charles. How are you?
I'm fine, David. Nice to talk to you today.
Good to talk to you. I'm calling you from not sunny, not warm Connecticut. I'm jealous, I think.
Well, just a couple of weeks ago, I slogged through snow in New York, Philadelphia, so I understand a little bit of that.
But you've been in Tucson for, I mean, you're not from there, but you've been in Tucson for quite a while.
All but three of the last 27 years.
Right, and you started Chax 1984, do I have that right?
1984, in August 1st, when I came to Tucson in a U-Haul trailer with a printing press in the trailer and parked it for my first week here at Leslie Martin Silko's ranch house in the Tucson Mountains just west of the city.
Very nice. And then you spent three years in the 90s when you were in Minnesota at the Minnesota Center for the Book.
Yes, in 93 through 95. Actually, I was director of Minnesota Center for Book Arts and then stayed in Minnesota for about a year after that while we figured out what was the next step in our life. And when I say our, I mean my family's, and my wife is a visual artist, primarily a painter.
So was it a culture and weather shock to move from Tucson, Arizona to Minnesota?
Well, not so much, because at that point I had been in Tucson a little less than a decade, so having come here from Madison, Wisconsin, so I knew the climate was not such a shock, and my wife actually grew up in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, at least until she was 10 years old. It was a different culture. One of the surprising things that I didn't necessarily expect was it called my attention to how much Tucson is filled with the new and the migratory, and how much the Twin Cities were, as one person told me at one point, 86% of the people in Minnesota have lived there all their life. And
yeah, that's
feeling the number in Arizona is way smaller than that.
Right. Well, because of course Arizona is the, in that Southwest Sun Belt, with Phoenix and like Las Vegas, attracting people from elsewhere at a ridiculous and unsustainable rate. But that's another conversation. We'll focus on Chax as a literary press, an art press in a certain way, if you will. But I just want to go back one further step into your background because it's pretty interesting. You studied with Walter Hamady, who ran and operated the Perishable Press in Madison for many, many years. He was a professor at University of Wisconsin. And I know you spent a lot of time working with him and learned, you learned printing from him.
I learned printing, I learned paper making, I learned bookbinding, I probably learned, a number of sort of specific stances within those acts, and Walter was my friend, too.
And so what, just curiosity here, what got you involved in printing book as object, handmade object? What motivated you when you first started, as a young person, learning, you were in college? What, it's a fairly unusual avocation or vocation to take up. Not many people are doing it. So, and what attracted you to it?
Well, I was actually in graduate school and was probably headed toward more of a literature professor kind of work, and yet a little bit dissatisfied with what I was studying, and I went to a week-long festival in Iowa City devoted to Charles Olson in November of 1978, and got my first glimpse there of small but rather elegant chapbooks being put out by the Toothpaste Press, as well as the studios of the Windhover Press there, and actually went back to Madison, Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin, looking at the course catalog and thinking, can I learn this stuff here? And had no idea. I was probably at certainly one of the best possible places I could be to learn that stuff if Walter Hamady would let me into his classes, and indeed he did. And I had no idea, you know, who he was or what the Perishable Press was at the time, but I was also absolutely delighted that he was, or he had at least published some books by specific writers, Paul Blackburn, Robert Duncan, Robert Creeley, George Offen, who I was actually getting some trouble from English professors in the English department who didn't particularly want me to read those authors in independent studies and things of the sort. So I not only found the practice, but I found a certain kind of home for ideas I had about poetry, too.
And, of course, you were then and are now a poet yourself.
Yes.
So the press is a kind of, as I see it anyway, an extension of your art.
Yes. And it's, to me, I never set out thinking I would be here, you know, 28, 30 years later doing this work. My models for such things were probably, you know, presses like the Objectivist Press of George Offen or the Divers Press of Creeley or Toowoomba Press of Lynn Hagenian, all of which seem to have lives of, you know, like a decade or less.
That's true. Well, for many, many poets, many writers over the years, maybe at least 100 years, have started publishing in that same impulse. It's the idea that somebody you know is doing something important and you want to get it out there for other people to see. But I think often the impulse fades as their other work may become more important. And the work of being a publisher is not inconsequential. It takes a lot of effort. And to sustain it, it requires some other skills that most writers probably don't have.
Although I don't think it's terribly hard to develop some of those, but it does take some time and intention. And I also think, you know, the probably most small presses, we don't have as much of those skills as we should have to succeed a little better than we do. But you have to have a certain amount to survive. You're right.
Well, and you're a nonprofit, an official 501c3, which makes you a charitable organization that can receive donations. Mm-hmm. How long when did you decide that you were kind of established enough and needed to be nonprofit in order to continue to exist?
About a year after moving to Tucson, we made that decision, and part of it was that certain people in State Arts Agency, I think it was, that saw what we were doing and did not have a precedent for funding anything like that, but knew it wasn't going to happen unless we did become a 501c3 organization. So we had some suggestions that we do so, and it turned out at the time not to be quite so difficult as I think it might be these days. But in 1985, the process didn't seem too bad, although it was about a year before we were approved as one. So officially in 1986, we became that.
And so, you know, just again, curiosity, but is how much a percentage of your operating budget is now comes from donations or grants or things like that, and how much comes from other sources of revenue?
We're pretty evenly funded in what I think of as three streams, and you know, not exactly one third each, but varying. It comes close to that from year to year. And so one third of that is specifically grants, whether from foundations or government sources. One third from individual donations, which range from as little as $5 to, you know, at times as much as $10,000 or $15,000, and the final third is book sales.
And has that been fairly steady through the years?
It's been pretty steady since the late 1990s. When we left here for Minnesota and that job at Minnesota Center for Book Arts, and the work of the press never stopped, but it's slowed down considerably, and then after we came back here, it took a few years after we returned here in 1996 to kind of get things on a fairly even keel again.
So I guess I, no, I sort of maybe we can turn to the kinds of your artistic vision and the kinds of books you produce, just to give a kind of sense. How many books have you published since you started? If you keep track.
Well, I was counting them up not too long ago, and we're several over 120 now.
And that doesn't include broadsides and occasional things like that.
It doesn't include broadsides, although it does include the occasional, you know, 24-page chapbook, something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty, you know, it's a significant body of work. Mostly poetry, if not all?
Mostly, not quite all. We've done a short story by Lydia Davis. We've done a novel by Diane Glancy, a novel by Hilton Odenzinger. We've done a couple of books of plays, although those have been plays by poets, one by Leslie Scalpino, one forthcoming by Will Alexander.
And so do you, when you first started, I know you were doing only letterpress on very interesting papers. The book was really objet d'art in a very significant way. I think that it was your artistic vision was to combine all of those other elements of artistic kind of manufacture to help promote the poetry as a word on the page. So there's the tactility of seeing and touching the words as they were imprinted into the paper was very important. But over the years, I think you've done other kinds of production methods. So, I think, you're not only a letterpress printer. You're not a printer for the sake of the object itself. It seems to me, and I may be putting words in your mouth, but the object is the work of the writing still, and that you'll use whatever technology works best to for the particular work you're trying to do.
Well, both whatever technology works best and whatever seems to serve the work best. When we first started making books that weren't entirely hand-printed and handset type and sometimes on paper we made ourselves was when I had a couple of manuscripts that both seemed, extremely long and challenging to do that kind of work for, but also that simply needed, audiences more in the 1,000 and more readers than in the, maybe at most a couple of hundred readers. And I remember specifically those were books by the Canadian poet B.P. Nichol and Ron Silliman, the American poet.
Right. So actually, what you're saying is that, I guess you're saying it maybe a little differently, but that the you will choose the technology based on the nature of the book that you're trying to publish.
Right, right. But one thing I'd also kind of want to stress is even the handmade books, we weren't doing beautiful books just to do beautiful books. I think the idea was, and even increasingly is when you do that kind of a book, to try to develop not just a lovely artistic vision for the book, but one which specifically engages what that writing is about or how it works in a significant way.
Right. So, I think that's what I was trying to say and probably did not say it very well. but I think of, what you're doing is trying to shape the artistic presentation of the work to enhance and better present the work itself.
Yes, and in some cases even to create a particular reading of that literary work that we believe in. Although I also, I'm quick when I say that to say, I'm happy if somebody else takes on the work and gives it a different reading, a different artistic temperament.
Right. But that's, I think, true of any writer, that with some exceptions, writers understand that once the work is out there, it's up to the reader to figure out what it means to them.
Absolutely.
I think some writers have felt more strongly than others. I think of maybe Robert Duncan as a good example, that he did not want there to be any ambiguity about how the work was meant to be read.
That's absolutely true, although Duncan certainly had no problem with an elegance of print being brought to his work.
Oh, no, he loved that.
Yeah.
I think he really appreciated it. I thought, I always was impressed by, you know, I have a broadside of his that was from a number of years ago where it was, he still made corrections on the broadside by hand.
It sounds like the one that we did.
It might be.
Because he corrected a French accent mark, and he was very, actually, humble to me, said he had missed it in proofreading, he was very sorry, and so all, I don't know, 100 or 150 copies of those, he made a little correction by hand.
Right, which is, you know, a sure sign of an absolute clarity of vision, I think. Which not many people have had.
Well, one note I saved and treasured from him when we produced that broadside, he wrote on top of the first proof, and he said, "It is something more than a pleasure to see that my text can be translated into a typography."
Mm. Well, that is, in fact, an interesting, I mean, I think that's still a point that is an issue today. You know, you remember probably a couple of months ago there was a big uproar about the e-book presentation of Allen Ginsberg's work, and particularly Howl, which was, you know, the typography in an e-book doesn't, you know, at least if it's, when it is a not carefully managed, the pagination does not persist, and the line lengths and indentations can be incorrect to the original work. So there was this notice that, in fact, Ginsberg's poems were not, you know, they were just converted to Kindle format, and they didn't work. And that's sort of involved now. You know, there's some response to that by people like Don Leeper in Minnesota, who I just interviewed the other day, who's created this thing called Ampersand, to, you know, to properly enable an e-book to represent the poem.
That's terrific. I mean, Don is somebody in the field who seems to be always on top of new technologies, yet highly aware of traditions of book printing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's something that is evolving. You know, I actually wanted to ask you about that, in the sense that your primary interest is in the physical book and in the traditional form of setting type by hand. And I'm kind of always interested in how the knowledge and skill and the awareness of design issues that a person in your position who is, when you handle type letter by letter, you have a different understanding of how words go together than when you work with words as kind of ephemeral digital objects that never are touched. And I think, and I'm, again, this is not a Luddite view of the world, it's simply an observation that there is a different understanding of the word itself when you created that word by hand than when the machine did it.
I think that's certainly right. But one of the things I also think is that, you know, there was a time 10, 20, probably 20 years ago and more, although it may survive to some degree, when book designers for whether academic books or more commercial books sort of spec'd type, and they would design title pages, chapter pages, and then kind of leave the rest to a typesetter or printer. And I think that's changed with the use of programs like InDesign and Quark Express, so that I know even when I'm designing a book on the computer for digital or offset reproduction, I am physically designing every page, every margin, every, you know, line break of poems, every enjambment that's necessary. And so I do still feel like, even though I'm sitting in front of a screen, it's not entirely hands-off.
No, that's true, but I guess I was leaping ahead to, I mean, because I do agree. I think what's interesting about Quark and InDesign is that they replicate the complexity of page design, typesetting. It's still by hand. Obviously, there's a distance there between the human and the type that's slightly different than handling the metal. But I agree, Quark and InDesign are actually very sophisticated, very complex programs to enable you to do all the things that you need to do to properly design a book. And I think they're very sophisticated and very successful. But when you go to there are certain formats of eBooks, the predominant formats, which are the .MOBI format for Kindle and the current version of EPUB for Nook and Sony Reader and maybe online reading, that the concept of the designed page is no longer in place because you're essentially scrolling a single long page to display it. Well, there is no page because your display, can be the display can be altered by the user in size of type or orientation. It can be portrait or landscape. So the concept of the page as an essential element is either thrown out or destroyed or obviated, depending on how you want to look at it. And I think that then there is a necessary reaction against that in cases where the page is really significant, where the location of specific words in orientation to the white space or to other words or to other letters has to be preserved in some way, for the ebook experience, the new versions of how that will be done, kind of equivalent to Quark and InDesign, I think still have not yet fully emerged. And so it's a
Right, but
really.
it also relates to me to, problems that precede that. That is, taking a manuscript by an author, and maybe this happens more in poetry where words are sometimes placed very specifically, lines are placed very specifically, but by an author who has designed for the way she or he works on a maybe an 8.5 by 11 page, or maybe on a computer program with a different kind of page setting, but to make that work in a book format that might be 5.5 by 8.5, 6 by 9, requires kind of amazing sensitivity and even often more collaboration between author and designer. And I don't know that that, of course, kind of collaboration happens so much when going to e-book because it is from its birth, it is a very commercial field.
Right. No, I think you're actually, that's a really important observation. I think in the general, but I think it's also true in general publishing, especially for fiction, the relation between the author and the production side is actually limited. And that's one of the things that an independent publisher or press, particularly artisanal craftspeople like yourself, can offer to a particular writer, and that is a collaboration in a way that the object, the book itself, represents the work in a way that is more specific and to the work than the commercial field enables in the first place. So in that way, the generalized ebook experience kind of replicates the generalized publishing experience. What I think is going to be interesting is that there will be studios and artisanal ebook creators who I think will come along, and maybe already, in fact, have probably already started to come along, because the need for making the dimensional presentation of the work electronically is just the same as it is in making the work specific to the page that you hand make in paper or hand print in type.
Well, and in a way, what you're saying takes me right back to my beginnings and to something learned from Walter Hamady, who talked consistently of the reading experience, and he likened a book to a Trojan horse that you allow it in because it seems enticing, but then once you open the page, you don't know what may happen, but it is going to happen right there between reader and book. And to make that experience both intimate and unique, I think, is something that has to remain a part of the reading experience, and I do hope develops in CE format.
No, I think actually you're very right. I think that, you know, what you're seeing is in the e-publishing and environment that, you know, there's a lot of change going on at all. I mean, there are people who are researching and thinking and innovating all the time. And some of them do not think about the user experience, which would be, the reader experience, and others think about it really deeply. I suspect that both things can happen. You know, I think that there will be an e-reading experience which is less than satisfactory because the people who are creating the objects, the experience itself, have not studied the history of human interaction with language in the print form. Or reading as an experience. I mean, there are other people who have been writing very perceptively about how does reading on a screen, how is it the same, you know, similar to reading on a page? How is it different? What do you need to do on a page to make it possible for people to read long, or on a screen to make it possible for people to read long form without becoming exhausted, or positively, how do you get them to become engaged in that experience in the way that book designers have thought about it? And, you know, what you have is about 500 years of, you know, kind of codified experience between the publisher, printer, technology, and the reader in the reading experience. And it's pretty well-developed as a body of knowledge. But in the electronic reading space, you have a much shorter time frame, a nearer horizon, so not as much time for study, reaction, you know, knowledge to have been developed. But I think that's happening now.
Yes, and to be very fair, despite the 500 years in the book, there are plenty of poorly designed books where where somebody hasn't taken into account all that 500 years.
Right, which is where sometimes commerce trumps the user experience.
Sometimes commerce, but also sometimes sheer enthusiasm. I mean, I know plenty of poets, writers who have also started presses, and they just wanted so badly to get the word out there, and the first books they put out, there are problems with it.
Well, that's true.
Even though some of those people have also developed into very interesting bookmakers over the years.
Well, that's true. I think, you know, many times the impulse is what gets them there.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of saying to themselves, well, I'm going to go out and learn how to be a publisher, I'm going to learn what printing is all about, I'm going to learn the history of book design, they basically figure it out for themselves. And sometimes, you know, that's a great way to start, and in other times, it's a great way to, you know, finish eventually.
Sure.
But I think that your observation is correct. I think that there are both things happen, and in a way, there's room for both. In other words, there may be plenty of publishing that is successful that does not pay that much attention to a careful understanding of a user-reader experience with the work. But I think there's plenty of room in the marketplace, commercial or otherwise, for the more sophisticated and view of what it is that one is doing when one creates these objects to be read.
Well, sure. Just think about how reading on a screen at all has developed over the last 30 years from, you know, yellowish or white characters on a black screen that had, you know, or like typewriter font, and, you know, to so called WYSIWYG, What You See Is What You Get screens. You know, in the current, you know, Apple computers, I mean, the basic, even if you're reading on a computer screen, the basic experience, you know, aesthetics has been considered.
No, that's true. No, I think it's, you know, we are about to see significant changes over the next few years. I mean, obviously the iPad has significantly altered the landscape and creates opportunities for people who want to be creative and make really interesting reading experiences. I think that opportunity is, you know, it's similar to having your own press in the basement the way you do.
Well, now I'm going to reveal, you know, my ignorance about what's going on. Just, I mean, I know about the iPad, but is there a format of ebook that has been developed specifically for the iPad?
Yes. Well, I would say yes and no. There is definitely a particular format that is required by the Apple operating system, which is called iOS, mm-hmm. and there are definitely people developing ebooks that take advantage of that platform. The latest development is there's this thing called EPUB 3, which is a standard that will be launched later this year that defines how an ebook will operate across platforms. And as I understand it anyway, the iPad environment will support EPUB 3, and that will include all of its various moving parts, you know, audio, video, and other kinds of objects. So yeah, then there are quite a few people who are developing ebooks specifically for the iPad, simply because Apple has created a device and with it an ecosystem of readers that they can work with.
Sure, sure.
So it's a very interesting time, and you know, for you know, someone, I mean, I can't say for sure, but I think somebody who is people who are doing the kind of work you are doing, kind of may likely gravitate toward the iPad environment because it offers so much in the way of support for individualized reading experiences.
Well, one reason this interests me, besides, you know, just possibilities for the publishing of Chax Press in the future, are, you know, of the 120 plus books we've published, those that aren't available anymore, would I seek to bring, to make some or most of them available in some kind of e-format rather than publish them all over again?
Right.
Some of them were published, you know, before we were even doing digital files for publishing.
Right, and the only way you could do that is to scan them
right.
with a high-quality scanner, and then you could, in fact, make them pretty readily available, I think. Probably you should talk to Don Leeper, because it sounds like Ampersand is a usable format for doing that.
Okay.
And on that note, I have to say this has been really fun to talk to you, and I think we could go on a lot longer, but I think we've reached the time when I have to end the conversation. But thank you, Charles Alexander, for talking to me about Chax Press in Tucson, Arizona. A publishing, a small, what I would call an independent literary art press. It's chax.org, and I'd recommend it to any of my listeners to check out the website and your blog. This has been David Wilk for Publishing Talks. Thanks so much.
Thank you.